It's that time.
Time.
Lock and load. The Michael Vary Show is on the air.
Apple, Facebook, Google, Instagram, Pinterest, Reddit, Shopify, Snapchat, Spotify, Twitter, Stripe have all removed Donald Trump's accounts. Microsoft, JP Morgan, Facebook, Goldman Sachs, Citi, Ford, FedEx, Dow, Marriott have all suspended political donations to anyone they perceive as having defended Trump and questioned the voter fraud of November 3rd. There is no room left in America for dissent. This is the inflection point. They've made clear what they're going to do, and now we have to decide what we're going to do. I get this question a lot. Michael, what do we do? And the answer is everything. Everything. All the time. What do I mean by that? I've said this before, so forgive me if you heard me say it. For the last 4 years, Donald Trump was president. Donald Trump was the strongest Republican president we've had in my lifetime. The guy most willing to go to bat for a policy agenda. The guy most willing to defy the media. The guy most willing to do something, even if they were going to paint him as an awful human being for doing it. Even with Donald Trump as president, think about everything that's happened in the last 4 years, right? So what does that mean? Does that mean we give up hope? If you're the type that's a quitter, yes, it is. This would be a good time to give up hope. Because if you give up hope and quit the process, you'll never be disappointed that you lost. A lot of people are emailing me that I'm quitting the process. I'm giving up. I refuse to be part of it. To which I say, more power to you. I'm not here to beg you back. If you can live with yourself that what you did when things got bad was turn, tell, and run, by all means, congratulations. If that makes you proud, but that's not who I am. But if even with Donald Trump as president, things were as bad as they've been, because I'm going to tell you, it's going to get a lot worse fast. That tells you that even winning the presidential election is not going to solve our problems. Why? Because every sphere of influence in this country is occupied not just by liberals, but by extreme radical liberals. The public schools. I don't have to tell you. The public schools are dominated by radicals. Even largely in rural districts where the people don't approve of it. Because they're willing to fight and we're not. That's just the reality. They're not afraid of you and you're afraid of them. You may personally not be, but a lot of other people are. The public schools from K through 12. The universities. They have so dominated the universities for so long. Faculty members with tenure are operatives for the Democrat Party. They're the reason climate change is such a big deal, because they take the government funding to the university, which is all professors are anymore. Professors are not teachers anymore. In fact, the most highly acclaimed professors don't even enter the classroom anymore. They do research, because research is where you get the money from the federal government. The money from the federal government pours into the university. So what do the Democrats and the federal government do? They write the bills such that the money goes to the research projects that they want undertaken. If you want a global warming grant, then you write a draft, a research request that says, I'll prove global warming is true based on this, this, and this. Here's $25 million for your university. That is how you become a well-respected, well-compensated professor. You are a revenue stream for the university. And to the extent that you do enter the classroom, or that those who you put in the classroom enter the classroom, everything is designed for the manipulation of the young mind. There is no truth left at the university level. Academia is not honest. Academia is not open. It is not a time to experiment with new ideas, to learn, to appreciate dissent. There is no marketplace of ideas. It is the stale, rotten, fetid ideas of socialism, Marxism, and in some cases, outright communism. And that is not an exaggeration. It is activism run amok, funded by the government, and the foot soldiers are the university students. But it doesn't stop there. And think about this. How hard we have all worked from the time our child is born to save up and send them to the university. Because going to the university is how they're going to improve their lives. And now we're beginning to see that's the worst thing you can do. We're beginning to see that veterans coming back after having served are more balanced, have better values, have better discipline, and in many cases are succeeding where the university student didn't. Because we finally saw the full transformation of our economy to the point where the need for people with psychology degrees has been exhausted. The need for people with sociology degrees has been exhausted. There are no longer enough positions in corporations for people who have these watered-down, blah, social science degrees, the easiest degrees to get, and I got one, to come into the corporation and make a difference. Some companies don't even require a college degree anymore. Major, even high-tech companies don't. We're seeing more and more that individuals who avoid universities and instead pursue the trades are seeing much greater success and happiness. And that's why they must be destroyed, because they didn't go to conformity school. They didn't go to intellectual finishing school. They don't buy into global warming. They ask questions about it. They don't wear the mask when they're told to. They ask questions about it. They don't subscribe to the lockdown because they run the businesses that are being locked down. They don't work in their pajamas all afternoon. It matters to them if we're locked down. There is a major transformation occurring in American society. And this is our wake-up call, folks. If you thought Twitter and Facebook and social media sites were going to save you, you should have seen the writing on the wall. They control them, we don't. So what do I do, Michael? Everything. The schools, the corporations, the churches, our military, your own household. I got an email from somebody today who said, I was at the protest at the Capitol. It wasn't violent. It was deeply patriotic. Please don't share my name. I don't want my family to know. If you're not willing to put your name behind what you personally witnessed, we have no hope.
This segment, exclusively produced by Hawaiian Chad Nakanishi. Aloha, broha. The Michael Berry Show.
In the night, I hear him talk, the coldest story ever told. Somewhere far along this road, he lost his soul to a woman so heartless. How could you be so heartless?
Oh, so if you just joined the show, talking about what Trumpism means to people. If you heard my morning show today, we do 3 hours in the morning and two in the evening. You heard me talking about, I asked the question of listeners, if Trump is silenced, what would be missing? What is Trumpism? Not who is Donald Trump to you, but what is Trumpism? And I say that because our battle is more than just electing a president. We've had the president for 4 years. and things were still on a negative trajectory, despite his best efforts. We have to fix our schools, our public schools, our public universities, our private schools. We have to fix our local government at the most local level. We have to fix our neighborhood associations. We have to fix our household. We have to fix every institution in America, from local to state to federal. But we need to understand what we are for, not just what we are against. Because there is a massive number of people out there, a market, waiting for leadership. And Donald Trump is not the only person. There are local, state, and federal offices available. There are products to be sold. We were notified this morning on Facebook that our account runs afoul of their rules because we are not part of their community standards, so that we are on the verge of being removed. I will tell you that would have bothered me a lot more because we have about 350,000 faithful followers on Facebook, and we had almost 80,000 on Twitter, but they've scaled that back as part of this purge. But I gave it some thought, and I said, you know what? I'm going to use that as a challenge to be better on this show and not rely on having multiple outlets to share my message. I'm going to be better on this show at conveying what I think is important, and we're going to return to using email, which is what we did over a decade ago, as a way to send out the details about the show when we're raising money for Camp Hope, when there's an article that we referred that we think people want to read. So if you haven't signed up for our email, that's now going to replace our Facebook efforts. You can go to michaelberryshow.com and sign up there. But I asked the question of our listeners, what does Trumpism mean to you? And I think this is important because, as I said in our first segment, there's a major effort underway to snuff out anything MAGA-related. So here are some things that Trumpism means to people. And I'm happy for you to share your thoughts as well. I'm going through this stack and organizing. Sorry. Romeo writes, promises made, promises kept. To actually serve the citizens of this country. To do their bidding. And not serving himself by merely lining his pockets and paying lip service to all his promises. To actually serve the citizens of this country. That was one of the themes that came through as to what Trumpism means. Trumpism is the philosophy, not the man. I heard this thread many, many times. People saying, the citizen servant, the leader who was worried about me. You know, the strange irony is that wealth was always considered a negative for a politician. Mitt Romney's wealth was used against him. Remember, he had multiple homes, and just before the election, they released the blueprints for his home, and there was an elevator for a car so that the car could be lifted up and more cars would be fit in there because apparently, I guess he has exotic cars or who knows what. His dad was once head of a major car company, so maybe cars are his thing. Who knows? But I remember Ann Coulter making the point in 2016 when Trump was landing at a big event and there was a rally, there was a big rally, and his plane, as he was leaving from that event, people were taking pictures of his plane. And she made the point that Romney was ashamed of his wealth and Trump was proud of it. Romney's wealth was used against him because he was not a man of the people. Trump's wealth was seen as a sign of his success, and most importantly, as a sign that he didn't need to do this, but was doing it because he believed so deeply. It's an interesting thing because I think that most people of great wealth in America are afraid to enter the public realm. A, because they lack the personality to do it. And B, because with great wealth, you lose the ability to be criticized. You lose the common touch. If you don't have to associate with the commoners, for many people, they simply don't. They build barriers between themselves and the public, literal and figurative. And whether that's a guard shack at the front of their home or their neighborhood, gates in front of their homes, the sort of figurative alligator moat to keep the public away. When you are an American politician, you are answering questions to the public. You are making yourself available to the public. Trump has done that as well as anyone I've seen in the modern era. As well as anyone in the modern era, and modern is important there because technology allows people to avoid the masses. Trump didn't give his speeches on a Zoom call. He didn't give his speeches into a camera like Biden did. He wanted the face-to-face. In fact, they criticized him for having mass rallies during the COVID era because what they really wanted to do was keep him from having mass rallies because people found energy in his presence. And more importantly, he seemed to revel in the presence of people. And I think you can expect Donald Trump to continue that, even post-presidency. And that's why, as we talked about, there is this move to label everything MAGA as domestic terrorism. And I wouldn't put it past them that they actually do this. And that brings us to the next issue. If, in fact, you silence people, if you take away their social media account, which is a place that people vent, if you take away their ability to gather, in an era where you've already locked them down, how long until that tinderbox blows? That's not good for anyone. This is not healthy. It is not healthy to pin people into a straitjacket and prevent them from expressing their opinions. That's true in every society throughout the course of humanity. That's what builds up into problems. That's what builds the anger, the frustration, the pent-up aggression. That is not a healthy way for a free society to behave. And the only people who can stop it are the Democrats who can demand that their fellow Democrats stop this nonsense, the media who can expose it, and the Republicans who can grow a backbone and buck up and stand up to it. Not one of those three, save and except Ted Cruz and a handful of others, has shown a willingness to do that yet.
I ain't asking nobody for nothing.
The Michael Berry Show continues.
If I can't get it on my own.
To my madness. It is important to write the history because if you don't, others will. And even if they do, there has to be a competing version. When Winston Churchill was once asked if history would be kind to him, he said, "Yes, it will, because I will write it." And of course, he had already written a history of the English-speaking people. He was a prolific author, in addition to being a prolific letter writer to his wife and others. Academic credentials, bona fides. It's important that you tell the story. How important is it that you tell the story? Well, look at what the left is doing in retelling stories, but with an alternate ending and a false narrative. American heroes are now demons. Other individuals are now American heroes. Individuals who are the right skin color or sex are now made into glamorized beacons of hope, even if their accomplishments were questionable or their motives were suspect. Those individuals are the great Americans, and those who you thought were American heroes, well, they're terrible people. And when you take control of the schools from preschool all the way up through the university, you control the minds. When you can tell people that red means go and green means stop, when you can set the language, when you can set the terms under which the discussion will be held, it gives you an incredible power. And what we're watching today is the old generation of you and me who were raised with traditional American values. These are our heroes. This is our history. This is the importance of our Constitution. This is what was going on in the rest of the world. A respect for those things, because that's what we were taught at home and at school and at church, on the ball field, among our friends, in the neighborhood. That's what we saw on television. It's what we saw in movies. It's what we saw in literature. It is us, the older folks, I'm 50, I'm on the back end of that, versus newer generations that have been taught exactly the opposite. And there's your clash. So how do you account for a Biden who's almost 80? He's speaking the language of that generation. The language that white people are bad people. That we must first help the minorities. In fact, Joe Biden said this over the weekend, talking about businesses that have been hurt by the COVID closures, and apparently everybody but white males will be prioritized.
Our focus will be on small businesses on Main Street that aren't wealthy and well-connected, that are facing real economic hardships through no fault of their own. Our priority will be Black, Latino, Asian, and Native American-owned small businesses, women-owned businesses. And finally, having equal access to resources needed to reopen and rebuild. But we're going to make a concerted effort to help small businesses in low-income communities, in big cities, small towns, rural communities that have faced systemic barriers to relief. Think of the mom-and-pop owner with a couple of employees who can't pick up the phone and call a banker, who doesn't have a lawyer, an accountant, to help them through this complicated process. To know if they're even qualified, or who simply didn't know where this relief is available in the first place.
Play that opening again. I want people to hear this clearly.
Our focus will be on small businesses on Main Street that aren't wealthy and well-connected, that are facing real economic hardships through no fault of their own. Our priority will be Black, Latino, Asian, and Native American-owned small businesses.
Our priority will be the non-whites. Why would you prioritize them? The opening statement was people who have suffered. On what basis do you say the non-whites have suffered more than the whites? This is a narrative that is being very, very carefully cultivated, and a lot of people have bought into it. And that is, life's just easier for white people. It's just harder for minorities. You know, I'm going to tell you something. My wife being Indian and us having a lot of friends who were Indian who came here, I have learned a lot about what it takes to succeed in this country based on how different groups who come here or who live here live. Now, we have to stereotype. We have to paint with the broad brush to have some of this conversation. But Indians who come to this country tend to thrive, especially first-generation Indians. In fact, I'd be interested to see if first-generation Indians don't do better than second-generation Indians, because first-generation Indians come here hungry. They come here having gone through Indian education. You will very rarely see an Indian come here before they finish their undergraduate degree. Now, they may come here for graduate school, and they may be a teaching assistant during graduate school that gives them enough money to pay for an apartment, which they share with other Indian students. This is how my wife came to this country. They share amongst themselves a cheap apartment. They make simple rice and dal, which is just a lentil bean and rice. They don't have cars. They don't buy things. They struggle. They work hard. They sacrifice. They get their graduate degree, usually in engineering. A lot of Indians will come here to study medicine, but they have to have been further along to do that. A lot of engineers, a lot of computer science folks. And then they begin to work, and they slog. And ask a business that has hired Indian programmers. They'll come in early. They'll stay late. They'll work weekends. They'll work long hours. They'll work for less money. And they eventually become very successful. Indian business owners, small business owners that I have seen who've come here who have succeeded, tend to out-succeed other groups because they will make every sacrifice known to man. Asian business owners, Vietnamese, for instance, who come here and struggle and sacrifice and own small businesses. The very types of businesses that were destroyed in Minneapolis by the types of people that Kamala Harris then raised bail money to get them out of jail. The very businesses that suffered in Portland and Seattle at the hands of Democrat mayors.
Michael Berry, known as the Czar, also known as El Tocino.
It's getting near dawn when lights close the tired eyes.
If I tell you that I saw Marie Osmond on TV earlier today, and she is the new spokesman for Publishers Clearinghouse. Do you think to yourself, oh, Marie Osmond, they must be going for the 70 and up crowd? Or do you think to yourself, how in the world is Publishers Clearinghouse still around? Do you know what Publishers Clearinghouse even sells? I mean, most people think of Publishers Clearinghouse as a sweepstakes company, right? Like a lottery. It's actually a company selling magazines, right? Yeah, that's what it is. Who would have thought? First of all, who still buys magazines? Ramon, do you get a single magazine at your house? Which one? You get Parents or Parenting? Parents Magazine, do you have one here with you? Have you read one of the articles? Does Amy read the articles? She does. There's no shame in that. She wants to be a good parent. Like, what would be one of the articles? How to Make No Mean No, or something like that. Okay. Bring it with you tomorrow. I'm kind of curious what... I used to read the hell out of Boys Life. Remember Boys Life? That was a good magazine. Not in my 40s, you weirdo! When I was like 10, you go to the doctor's office. In the old days, the doctors would all have magazines out front. And you know what's funny? When I was growing up, I was born in 70. So in 1980, when you went to the doctor's office, they would have magazines. The magazine that had just come out. 40 years later, if you go to the doctor's office, they still have magazines. That same magazine! Sometimes they'll have magazines that are 15, 20 years old. Which to me, I'm a nostalgia guy, I find to be thoroughly fascinating. I want to get back to the subject we've been talking about. What is Trumpism to you? But I printed this out. Thought you might be interested in it. San Francisco teachers are not going back to teach, by the way. San Francisco teachers are also demanding the district install lids on every toilet, which would be closed during flushing, to presumably prevent the spread of the virus through aerosols or droplets released although none of the millions of cases worldwide has been connected to a toilet. Let me read that again. So San Francisco teachers are refusing to go back to the schools unless a series of things that they're demanding are met. This is a holdout. It's a hostage negotiation. San Francisco teachers are also demanding the district install lids on every toilet, which would be closed during flushing to presumably prevent the spread of the virus through aerosols or droplets released. Although none of the millions of cases worldwide has been connected to a toilet. These are those heroic teachers that Microsoft tells us about in their ads. Here's to the heroic teachers. Well, they don't think the teachers are heroic. The teachers are the ones who've been using the Zoom or whatever the, is Zoom a Microsoft product? Whatever the Microsoft product is, Microsoft videos, and Microsoft has made money off of this. It's important to remember that during this year, when so many livelihoods were destroyed, so many people suffered, so many children didn't have a Christmas, so many families have suffered and struggled because mommy and or daddy lost their job, lost their wages, didn't know where their income would come from, lost their family business, lost their side business, which is how they bought ice cream for the family and the nice things that make life worth living. It's important to remember that not everyone had a bad year. Microsoft probably had a great year because more people probably bought their software package. Amazon had a fantastic year. Because if you don't leave your house, some things have to come to you. Enter Amazon. I don't fault them. I'm a big believer in capitalism. But this ain't capitalism. Capitalism is a free market. And all too often, the American system is marred by a lack of a free market. And it is often marred by a lack of a free market by the very competitors in the market who use government against their neighbors, against their competitors. The Bill Gateses, the Microsofts, the Amazons, the Walmarts, they love the shutdown. Because if everybody's shut down, you're still going to buy things. And now the choices from whom you can buy it have been limited to Amazon, Walmart, and a handful of others. And so as businesses have died, as consumer choices have died, so too competition. And now we're going to be left. We already are. We're seeing this with the censorship on the left. We're going to be left with a couple of internet companies, major internet companies, and a couple of retailers, and a lack of any choice. I read earlier today that Biden already has in his administration, high up in his administration, 14 senior big tech executives. They're going to be making policy. Do you think big tech executives are going to favor reopening sooner rather than later when they make money off of big tech? They'd just as soon we live in a world where none of us can leave, because they'll always be able to leave. We know that. We know that they don't follow the rules they impose upon the rest of us. So there will be a big tech push. The leader of the Biden Foundation that was supposed to be raising money for cancer, because remember he exploited his son's death. His son died of brain cancer. So he had this foundation that apparently they were all living off of that raised millions of dollars but never gave it to cancer. The guy who led that, a Pfizer executive. They keep telling us. I had a friend of mine tell me the other day, oh, Big Pharma's not making anything off COVID. You believe that? And when you find out they did, you're going to somehow be shocked, disappointed, dismayed? I don't think you should be. The rise of big tech, the rise of big pharma, the rise of big media, the rise of big government, are a tide against which the rest of us are struggling, and bad times are upon us. I'm not telling you to lose faith or lose hope. I'm telling you to batten down the hatches. It's going to get a lot worse before it gets any better. And it's important to watch and see who's fighting for you, who's fighting against you, and who is fighting against you by not fighting for you when you elected them to do so. Because there's going to be a day of reckoning that comes.
It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Berry Show is on the air.
The Republican Party didn't see Donald Trump coming in 2016. Jeb Bush was the nominee. Jeb Bush raised more money in that primary than has ever been raised in a primary before. It may be than will ever be raised again, at least for a very long time, until the effects of inflation kick in. Here's a man whose brother had been elected president for two terms, whose father served one term, ran for a second, and had been for 8 years before that the vice president. Before that, had been the head of the Republican Party and the CIA. Had been a congressman before that and had run for a senator. Jeb Bush was to have been the third member of that immediate household to be a Republican or to be the president of the United States. That's who the establishment wanted. We have one household in this family capable of birthing a president. Think about that. We have one name. And what was Romney? But another version of the same politics, the big money, the family connection, his father, George Romney, before that. What was John McCain? But another from this. But Jeb Bush in 2016 was supposed to be the nominee. The establishment that picks our Republican candidates picked him. There may have been 17 candidates running, but the money was behind Jeb. And the names, the big names, the guys who make the decisions, the guys who have the relationships with the George Wills and the Bill Crystals, they had all lined up and they had picked. And they live this. So they picked their candidate long before you even know who's running. And Jeb was the candidate. The problem was Jeb wasn't up to the task. Jeb is weak. He may have been the governor of Florida. He may have looked good on paper. He had brown grandchildren, a brown wife. He had a presidential pedigree. He had been governor of the state that is the purple state that Republicans have to win. Oh, he's just great. Jeb. Well, there was a reason they had to put an exclamation mark behind his last name. To tell you to be excited because you wouldn't be otherwise. What Donald Trump did to him, Donald Trump did to a lot of people who went on to become the Lincoln Project or Jennifer Rubin or Max Boot or you name it. He didn't just defeat them. He broke them. He broke a number of supposedly conservative writers that were the next generation of Bill Buckley. He broke him. He left him so devastated, a pile of bones and dust, that even when he posts a tweet or makes a public statement, he looks like he's wincing, like at any minute somebody might come up behind him and thump him on the ear. He looks like somebody who has been bullied and beaten. He's broken because Trump had to break him. Trump had to get inside his head and expose him to the people that you don't need another weakling like this. And it's important to understand why people voted for Trump. I suspect that for most of you, some or all of the reasons you voted for him, if you were an early supporter anyway, are reasons I'm going to read because these came from your fellow listeners. But it's important that candidates understand you can't silence the MAGA movement. You can't silence the Trump supporter. You can think it's a cult of personality. And sure, some people will say, I'm for Donald Trump. And when Trump's gone, they'll leave the process. But a lot of people have recognized, hey, wait a second, I'm not in the minority. There's more of me than there are of them. I'm not going away. I'm not going to let them kick me away. So I'd like to read from you. And again, this morning on our early show, I asked people to tell, what does Trumpism mean to you? Because we have city council members and school board members and state reps and state senators and governors and congressmen listening to this show. And you need to hear what people are saying. The only time Republicans won prior to November 3rd of this year, the only time that Republicans won a contested presidential election before Trump was 2004. A string of losses to Democrats. Joan writes, Czar Trumpism is what he called it at his inauguration. The power is in the hands of the people. It is the forgotten man and America first. America first is a thread that I received. I mean, I read hundreds and hundreds of these emails, and I heard America first, nationalism, putting American workers first, putting American companies first, putting American taxpayers first. I heard over and over and over again the willingness to stand up for us against the media, against the establishment. Here's another one. Alton, who's Vietnamese-American, says, standing up to face the swamp as he did as a billionaire, knowing that they will fight back. It's obvious that the Democrats won't stop their witch hunt until he loses everything he worked for his whole life. I heard that over and over and over again. So many of these people, it's about five things that people said over and over again. The willingness to stand up for it. Here's another one. I'm reading the life of James Adams, and I believe Donald Trump understands the great struggles and difficulties of our forefathers to establish the Constitution. Here's another one. Jared writes, Trumpism is fighting back with no apologies. Everything has to be taken in context to what's happening around it and what happened before it. Trump was the guy who came out, and when they said, you're a bad guy, instead of saying, I am, please forgive me, Trump was the guy who pushed back, who fought back. Did it seem ugly and nasty? Yeah, because you'd never seen anybody fight back. We didn't know what it looked like to fight back. Romney never fought back. McCain never fought back. They didn't want to fight back against the media. It's very important that you let them beat your corpse blue and smile, because the greatest compliment they can give you in defeat is that you were a gracious loser. What is Mitt Romney but the perfect Republican to Democrats, a loser who smiles while he's losing? He ran for president, for God's sakes. He won the nomination. He got within a whisker of winning, and he comes back and says, how about I be a senator? Are you so desperate to be talked about? Can you find no other value in life running for the Senate after all of that and spending your whole time with these people who made fun of your binders full of women and your dog on the roof? Saying, oh, but he's a good Republican now. We'll put him in at the Washington Generals.
Michael Berry Show.
Last night I dug your picture out from our old dresser drawer. I set it on the table and I talk.
Well, at some point, we're going
to
move beyond procedures and personalities, silencing those with whom we disagree, and Democrats are going to attempt to enact their agenda. And that includes the tenets of the Green New Deal in all their forms. That includes climate change. That includes the left's desire to take control of manufacturing. It includes far more than that. And let's talk about why. Gregory Wrightstone is a geologist and the executive director of the CO2 Coalition. He's the best-selling author of Inconvenient Facts, the science that Al Gore doesn't want you to know. Gregory, let's first talk about how you got interested in this subject. Obviously, as a geologist, you're a scientist, you're a truth seeker, but how did you come to this particular public policy issue as a course of study?
Yeah, that's a great intro to this, and it's I did not set out to write a book. As a geologist, though, I knew some of what we were being told about climate change was just wrong, based on my scientific data. That was actually it was ocean acidification, which I knew has never happened in the past, even at much higher CO2 levels. I knew that some of that was wrong, and I suspect that other things were. So really, this started several years ago as a search for the truth. I was told one thing, and as I started looking into it, I found that the science, the facts, and the data just didn't back that up. And it was one thing after another I found that we were being told that was just incorrect. And I like to let the science and the facts lead me to the correct answer. And we just saw time and time and time again about if it wasn't fires or tornadoes or hurricanes, what we're being told by the media just was not supported by the scientific facts. And that's really what led to this book, and really an exposure of the corruption that we've seen in the scientific process. And it's borne out and exposed here in this climate change debate. And
talk about the details behind that. What kind of information did you see? What kind of conclusions did you begin to draw? What were the data points upon which you started developing this conclusion?
Oh boy, it was. I just started exploring. Forest fires was a great example, because if you didn't actually look at the data, you would think that fires are raging out of control and increasing year after year after year. Worldwide, that's just not the case. And what we found, and as I got into it, we've seen that there's actually been a long 100-plus year decline in both area burned and fires, number of fires. And that's in the United States. Except for last year in California, it bumped up a little bit, but according to the fire service in California, even the California, the number of fires had declined over the years. Just things like that. Another great example, well, it's not great, it angers me, but an example, I'm sure you and your listeners have heard about this supposed sixth mass extinction event that's looming over us, and that species are going extinct right and left, and it's an increasing. And in fact, there was a UN report at the end of 2019 that was released, and that in that report, this United Nations report put together by the United Nations scientists reported that there may be as many as 1 million species go extinct over the next several decades. And I looked at that, and, well, that would, if you're going to go 1 million species over several decades, you would need to have 25,000 to 30,000 species go extinct per year. Well, I went back, and I, as is my wont, I went back and I actually got the same data that the UN used. It's called the IUCN Red List, and your listeners can just Google Red List, and they can go find that. It took some work to get all the data together. I looked at the same data that the UN looked at, and I found, remember, the UN said there would be 1 million species go extinct over several decades. I looked at that same data. I'm not going to make you guess. The average, remember, 25,000 to 30,000 species would need to go extinct per year. The average over the last 40 years is, all right, wait, you ready for it? 2.
Wow.
Not 2,000, not 200, two species going extinct per year. But no, the UN tells us, oh, no, there'll be 25,000 to 30,000. Well, it's not even close. Species extinctions have been in significant decline for the last 100-plus years, and they peaked in the late 1800s. So the big story should have been, in this UN report, should not have been, oh, my God, the species extinctions is out of control, and it's getting terrible, it's terrible. The true report should have said, man, we're doing a really good job protecting endangered species.
Right.
That should have been the conclusion instead of what they concluded, which was just opposite. And that's just one glaring example. And in fact, they used my data. Patrick Moore and Mark Morano both used my data when testifying before both the United States House and the United States Senate concerning this UN report. And use that. So it's part of the congressional record, is actually the work that I did to expose these lies.
So when you look at man-made climate change, when you look at man's contribution to the environment, is it negligible? Is it nothing? Is it more than we'd like but less than they say? Where would you rate that to be?
Mankind has had a negative effect on our environment, but we're getting better. I mean, no one can argue that we had polluted air, we had polluted water. If we look back at the early 20th century, of course, there were bad things done. But what we see now is our air and our water, they're cleaner than they've been in probably hundreds of years. And it's getting better and better and better every year. In fact, you can just Google EPA pollution if you don't believe me, and you can see what what the EPA has to say about that. And the EPA tells us that just what I said: our air and our water are cleaner than they've been since they've got the records of it, and we get better and better and better and cleaner every year, and that's a good thing. Now, if we talk about the demonized carbon dioxide molecule, which they'll contend is a pollutant. It is not. It's, instead of the demon molecule, it should be considered the miracle molecule from which plant life and all life on Earth relies on carbon dioxide. And it is, so CO2, carbon dioxide, has been increasing, and we're at the beginning of the 20th century, or the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. I'm not going to give a bunch of numbers out, but we were at about 280 parts per million. We're a little over 400 parts per million today. And green CO2 is a greenhouse gas, so the increase in CO2 contributes some warming to the atmosphere. I'll acknowledge that, but we believe that it's modest, and it's greatly overwhelmed by the same natural forces that have been driving temperature really up and down since the dawn of time. And those natural forces that we see captured in the rock record, and as a geologist I look at that type of thing, we see the temperature's been cycling up and down periodically, sometimes greatly, and sometimes not as much. But that natural cycle of heating and cooling didn't end in the beginning of the 20th century. It didn't end when we started driving SUVs. Those same natural forces are at work and play today, just as they have been, again, since the dawn of time.
With the motto, carbon dioxide is essential for life, the website is CO2coalition.org. I'd love to have you back as the left begins trying to push their agenda in the coming months and years in a Biden-Harris administration. I appreciate the fact that there are some people who are driven by a pursuit of truth and not the pursuit of power for government. Thank you for being our guest, Gregory Whitestone.
Thank you.
Gregory Wrightstone, sorry.
Thank you.
You've got...
Corn Pop was a bad dude.
The Michael Berry Show.
She stood in the street, smiling from her head to her feet. I said,
city. Hey, now, what is this? Now, baby, maybe, maybe she's in need of a kiss. I said, hey, what's your name, baby? Maybe we can see.
In 2008, when John McCain was a Republican nominee, I felt a great deal of frustration that by the time the vote came to Texas, which is late in the process, it's in March, the nominee was already chosen. In 2012, by the time the process got to Texas, the nominee was already chosen. And in fact, if you look at the Republican, if you look at the process, let's see if I got it up here. I did. I guess I threw it away. I had the list of the early primaries and caucuses. You spend 4 years in the presidential election leading up to those early caucuses and primaries. Iowa, that first caucus. New Hampshire, that first primary. And most of the field is already thinned by the time you get to the third one, which I believe is South Carolina. Which means that Iowa and then New Hampshire have the greatest influence in who the Republican Party nominee will be. So the voters don't have a choice, especially when you consider that Iowa is more purple down the middle than most states, and that New Hampshire is a Democrat state. So you've got Republicans in a Democrat state choosing your nominee in a state they're not going to win in November. That doesn't make any sense. But nobody dares criticize, because then you can't win New Hampshire. Because if you criticize that, then when it comes to the New Hampshire primary, they'll say, you're the guy that wanted us put to the back of the line. What matters in winning November is what? Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, which is last in the process, or close enough to it, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. Do you notice that those aren't states that are important in the primary process? The states that are important in the primary process are not states that are important in November. The states that are important in the primary process are states that by the time they vote, the nominee is chosen. So we limp to November every year with a nominee that we don't like. Prior to Trump, tell me your thoughts in your mind. Say it out loud. In 12, you had Romney. In 8, you had McCain. In 4, you had Bush running for re-election. After 2000, you had Bush. In 96, you had Bob Dole. 92, you had George W. Bush, H.W. Bush. In 88, you had George H.W. Bush. Bob Dole in 96. Bob Dole, the Mitch McConnell of 1996. A guy who had been Senate Majority Leader or Minority Leader for about 150 years. Bob Dole, who Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, called the tax collector for the welfare state. Bob Dole, Mr. Big Government Republican. Then in 2008, well, then a Bush after that for two terms. Then in 2008, John McCain. We criticize how long Joe Biden's been in the Senate. Do you know how long John McCain had been in the Senate? Then in 2012, Mitt Romney, a guy who'd been a governor of one state, a guy who basically claimed residency in Michigan, Massachusetts, and Utah, a guy whose daddy had run for president, and a guy whose dad was a Fortune 500, basically quasi-governmental, major international corporation CEO. So I'm reading these all day long, and I say to myself, no wonder people were attracted to Trumpism. The idea that the American working man matters? The idea that made in America means something? The idea that instead of sending money to all these foreign countries, we give it back to the taxpayer and invest it here? The idea that the United Nations and the Paris Accords don't govern American actions? The average, everyday American will have a smaller voice tomorrow than he had yesterday. And he had very little voice yesterday. Because the social media accounts are being purged. CNN called on cable companies to remove Fox News. That's what CNN now stands for. The American left has spent decades saying that what they want is goodness and fairness, and when the ref's not looking, punching you in the face. And now, they don't have to hide it anymore. Jake Tapper is showing exactly who he is. Which, by the way, I read it at length this morning. I won't do that now. Fox News used to dominate 10 of the 12 top shows in cable ratings. Cable news ratings were Fox News. Fox News is now, their best show is now 17th, which is behind Brian Williams on MSNBC, who's 15th at 11 p.m. Brian Williams, who's only the fourth highest rated show at MSNBC, is now ahead of the top show on Fox, which is during primetime, 5 p.m., which is The 5. Pretty amazing. Because of Chris Wallace's question of Donald Trump, and because Fox News had a clear Joe Biden bias the night of the election. It's going to cost him.
This is...
You may cut me, man, but I'm going to wrap this chain around your head.
The Michael Berry Show.
National divorce. It's a conversation that a lot of people have been having over the last few months and even years. Is it time that we go our separate ways? The point at which we can no longer allow someone with whom we disagree to have a Twitter page or a Parler page or a Facebook page or Instagram or a public presence is the point at which we need a divorce. It sounds like we have so little in common that maybe it's time to go a different direction. Paul Preston is the founder and president of The Movement for a New California State. He's also the host of Red State Talk Radio's Agenda 21 Radio. The Movement for a New California State. Is that a real movement, Paul?
It absolutely is. It's alive and well. It's happening, and we're going to become the next state in the Union of States called the United States of America. Will be number 51.
Now, do you get to be the president of it if there is, in fact, a new state? Is that like the reward?
No. No, my job is to make this whole thing come true, and we'll have a governor. In fact, we'll have a pretty soon, it looks like we're going to have a provisional governor that we're going to, or interim, that we're going to be looking at and talking to. We've made a couple of overtures, actually, to your former Governor Perry and to Mike Huckabee, and we're going to be in the business here in the next couple of months of making further overtures to other people that now appear to be very interested in New California to be the interim governor, so we're pretty excited about that.
I noticed on your page there's reference to following the West Virginia statehood model of 1861. Talk a little bit about the precedent behind this.
Well, what we're doing is following what's already in the Constitution, which is Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution. And that provides for if you have a group of people, a group of citizens in a state, and you decide you're not really happy with what's going on in the state itself, you can actually form another state from that original state. And that's called the New States Clause, Article 4, Section 3, which states that if you want to form a state from a pre-existing state, then you have to get the consent of the legislatures concerned and then that of the Congress. And it's very simple wording. It's, most of the stuff that's in the Constitution is very, very simple and straightforward. And of course, words do have meaning. But the situation with Article 4, Section 3 is what we're following. And it's only been done actually three other times in history, Maine, Kentucky, and then West Virginia, as you talked about. And we're following the West Virginia model. We are following the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights as our playbook and manual, if you will. And then we're using history, the history of not only just West Virginia, but how other states became states within the Union. You know, it's really is a fascinating study to find out how all 50 states became members of the Union. And, you know, all the different dramas behind each one. Every state has had its own drama, but California came in, really the only state that came in under a bill which bypassed much of the process of a new state formation in 1850. But New California, we're following it by the Constitution, by the book, where you've got county committees set up in 56 counties already. And we're working towards working with the state legislature and then moving on to Congress. There's no election for this. The election process, the executive branch, such as our governor, is totally irrelevant in the process, as well as the judiciary. And that was made that way because, you know, the founding fathers realized that if the people were fed up with the government, they'd probably be fed up with all branches of the government, but more likely the executive and the judiciary because of maybe bad rulings or, you know, a governor acting like a dictator, which is what we have here in California. So they gave the people the out by forming a new state on their own, and they made sure that they were exclusively only working with those people that they should be working with the most, and that's the legislature. And oddly enough, you've seen the attempt by the president to reactivate legislatures around the country because legislatures have actual, you know, authorities over certain things. One of them is new statehood, and the other one is elections. And think about that. So the legislatures in all 50 states have authorities, complete authorities over the election system. And, of course, you've seen that being bypassed and usurped by way of the executive or even the judiciary branches by making orders on their own and controlling elections when they had no business doing that only the legislature can do. That's a problem out here in California for sure. It's a problem in every state. But the president, because of the election situation, has pointed out properly that all these states that were the battleground states, and almost all of them that use the Dominion system, have violated their tenets of every legislature and the laws that go along with the codes that they developed in the legislature to guide a good election. So if you take a look at it, certainly out here in California, we've got a fraudulent election system. And in fact, so much so that it's prompted a lawsuit on our part. We're suing the governor and the secretary of state from New California for election fraud. And our case is actually moving quite well. We were denied a shortened motion. The implication of our lawsuit, which we will prevail, it's pretty straightforward. We could mean that the entire down ballot of California that was besides the executive, in other words, the presidential election, it will actually have to be revoted on. And revoted without the Dominion systems, which is absolutely an amazing thing to think about. So we're pretty happy with that lawsuit moving forward. This is actually our second lawsuit. Our first lawsuit was to join up with Texas being claimed that we were harmed. In fact, it looks like California, New California, is the only case There's only one time in American history that a Supreme Court has taken up a case by a potential new state, and that's with our amicus brief that we filed alongside with Texas in regards to the election fraud that's gone on in the other five, the battleground states. So we feel very, very fortunate to be among great, great states, but, you know, like I said, we're several months away from seeing the results of our efforts of becoming a state, but I think that at the end of the day, we're going to be on the state quite quickly.
The website is newcaliforniastate.com. If you'd like to learn more, his name is Paul Preston. You're welcome to reach out to him there. I wish you the best of luck. I think that this should be a wake-up call to a number of folks around the country that we're not simply going to live in a system where there is a lack of respect, a lack of accountability, taxation without representation, and everything that goes into the mentality that caused us to split with our cousins in the first place. I wish you the absolute best of luck. NewCaliforniaState.com. We'll be right back.